From Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor McConnell. Hello and welcome to episode 5 of this season of the Dying Matters podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. This week, we're chatting to journalist and author Kevin Tulis. Kevin spent much of his career dealing with death, first as a journalist, reporting and making films from conflict zones, but recently he started interrogating death and dying in a much more personal way. He used his experiences with death to write My Father's Wake, which is both an incredibly intimate and detailed account of the wake of his father, and a reflection on how embracing the Irish way of dealing with death might help us to face our own mortality without fear. It was a really interesting conversation. Hope you enjoy.
But what happened is I had a kind of career as a reporter. I think it emerged out of my own personal experiences. I had a brother who died young. I was 19 and he was 26. It was a big battle against leukemia. He had a bone marrow transplant. And I suppose that changed my perspective on death. At a very early age. And then I stumbled into reporting. And so I reported a lot on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And I developed an acute and very dangerous gift where I was absolutely fantastic at knocking on the door of a perfect stranger, crossing the threshold, sitting down on the sofa, and within about 5 minutes asking you about the worst thing that ever happened to you in your life, which usually consisted of the death of your son, the death of your brother, the trauma involved, and I reported on a lot of conflict. And then later on, I did quite a lot in the Middle East, in famines and wars and plagues, interviewed lots of people connected with suicide bombing, because I made a history, a five-part series for Channel 4 on the cult of the suicide bomber and then the history of the car bomb. So I've seen a lot of conflict and trauma and the after effects of that trauma, whether it's crime or terrorism. And all of that really, impacted on my thinking on death and how do we deal with death. But I suppose the solution to this long quest, trying to understand death, came back really in the village where my family are from on the west coast of Ireland, where we've lived for 250 years. And it was with the death of my own father, who died in a very traditional Irish way, embraced by the rite of the wake, so that his community embraced his dying. They came to see him as he was dying. He knew he was dying. He was dying of pancreatic cancer. There was no shame. There was no shunning. There was no revulsion. The house was full of people coming to see this man, to say goodbye, to talk about his death. They didn't really have the same Western fear that we have. What should we talk about? Can we not talk about death? These people were perfectly open, perfectly relaxed about it. It wasn't the easiest experience in life. But then when my father died, he died at home. He was literally cradled into death. By a group of local people, mainly local women. In Irish, it's called Imrá Cinse. And they literally sort of prayed. They did it's a very familiar Catholic prayer, the Hail Mary. At the bottom of his deathbed, as he was dying, they were praying. Even so that the last sounds that he heard would be this very familiar lullaby, Catholic prayer that every Catholic child from the ages of 4 would know. But it could have been a Buddhist prayer, it could have been an Islamic prayer, it could have been a Jewish prayer. It's just this very familiar mantra. And it was an act of grace, really, where what they were doing was seeing this man, the passage out, giving him the best death that he could possibly expect, the best death that we could expect. And then when he died, his body was washed by his daughter and by his sister-in-law, just as the Trojan woman had washed Hector's body at the fall of Troy, that he was then openly waked in the adjoining sitting room. All the neighbours came. Children played at the foot of the coffin. We waked all night. There was a lot of sorrow, keening, and laughter and joy, and a celebration of his life. And then we buried him. And then, I suppose, so the end of this long journey of being in lots of different situations, seeing children die of starvation in Sudan, people being blown up in Gaza, a lot of kind of crime. I came back really to the beginning point, which was, what's the best way to deal with death? And it was, I think, and that's what I write about a lot, through the communal gathering, a communal way of death, which is very similar, if not identical, to something like an Irish wake.
Yeah, so it's about a community sort of response to loss and death that you think we've sort of lost.
Well, the wake is it's like a bit of software that you pass down from generation to generation, where you as a child go to wakes, people go to funerals, they're very familiar with the concept of dying. They expose themselves from a very early age. So they take children to wakes. Irish people love taking children to funerals. I mean, we think, my God, how can they possibly do this? I mean, we get very worried about the Grim Reaper and write books about how to teach children about death, and we have lots of sort of grief and counselling and therapy. But the best thing that you can do is just go along to a wake. Because there in the wake, what you'll see is a dead human, a dead one of us. And you learn more in that hour in the company of the dead than you will from endless degrees in death studies. We don't need another professional cast of counsellors and more degrees and more academics. If you breathe, then you are just as qualified as anyone else to wonder about mortality and to come up with your own solution and thoughts. But what the Irish really do in the Irish wake is they pass on this knowledge from generation to generation. If you think about it, if death was like a marathon that you had to run, and just the whistle went off and you had to run 26 miles, even if you were sitting at your desk, or someone that you loved was going to run that marathon, then I think it's a really good idea, rather than pretending that you're not going to have to run the marathon, is if you just do a few practice laps around the local park first. And so that's really what the Irish are doing in the wake. But also it's very common in all world cultures. It's common in Africa, Southern Europe. It's only in the West and sort of Western Europe and in America over the last 200 years that we've abstracted the dying from the living and the dead from the world of the living. And we've done that through hospitals, through professional undertakers, through changes in social rights. But what the Irish are doing really is they're still integrating dying amongst the world of the living. And principally because you take your kids along to a funeral and wake and you see a dead body, and then they go home at night and they watch, you know, they have beans on toast and watch Teletubbies or their favourite programme on Netflix, and they just go on with life because, you know what, it's a perfectly normal part of life. But what you're really doing is you're building up a kind of social reservoir of, encounters with bereavement. So you know what to do when someone has lost someone they love, that you acknowledge that in public. The Irish shake your hand and say, sorry for your trouble. And they'll often actually come up to you afterwards, like in the supermarket, for months afterwards, if it's the first time they've seen you, and they'll shake your hand. They'll go out of their way to acknowledge that you've lost someone that you've loved. And if they're under a social obligation to do that, to acknowledge this death, which is obviously a much better way of publicly acknowledging that things have changed in your life, that you've lost someone, than just complete denial and, you know, frozen embarrassment and not knowing what to do. But the whole point about the wake is it just basically passes on this knowledge about encounters with death from one generation to the other. And so it helps you understand what the process is like. And the process of our own dying will not be, although we in the West sort of, we're too afraid of death, we're too anxious about it, we personalise it too much. But the process of our dying will not be so very different from the process of dying of the generation before us and the generation before that. Things might change, medical treatments will change, but in essence, the process of dying won't be so different. So if we are able to encounter that early on, we'll understand where we're going and what's happening with ourselves or what's happening with our relatives. If we pretend it's not going to happen or we have no knowledge of it, then clearly it becomes a lot more fearful because you're afraid of the unknown.
Yeah. And I think that public acknowledgement of death is something that is still so unusual in this country, in other Western countries. It's something you hear all the time about people who are bereaved, about how lonely it is. And, you know, even after the period of the funeral, not wanting people to assume that they don't want to talk about it and needing people to bring it up and feeling embarrassed to bring them up themselves because somehow it feels gratuitous or like you're sort of wallowing in your loss unfairly, which just makes the experience so much more lonely.
Yeah, I mean, so the book I wrote is called My Father's Wake, you know, How the Irish Teach Us to Live, Love and Die. And what it really does is it tries to extrapolate those lessons of that social experience. And in essence, it's a pretty simple formula. It's like practicing, that you just practice. If you had a 13-year-old child, would you give them the keys to the car and say, oh, just get in the car? You'll find out how it works. If you do left and right, and you know it'll solve itself. Oddly, we train all our lives for... train for exams, we train to be a lawyer, we certainly train how to drive a car, you train how to, you know, how to cook recipe. What's extraordinary in the kind of Western death machine in our society is that we just don't actually have any training at all for mortality studies. You know, we have lots, we teach kids about sex education, but as far as I'm aware, there's not 1 hour on the Western curriculum for mortality studies. What is it like to be human? What is it like to die? What happens when, what happens when people do die? What happens when people get sick? What should you do at funerals? What should you do about the bereaved? All of these incredibly complex, absolutely universal and compulsory human emotions, human states, whether it's grief or love or loss, in the aftermath, we have no training whatsoever. And that is a very peculiar omission. And again, if you have a rite like the Irish Wake, what you're really doing is you're embedding all of that knowledge in the rite. So you're 12 and you go along to see your granny, or maybe you go to see someone like someone who we would regard as more remote. It could be an old man in the village. It could be a tragic death. But you go along. And you're there in the company of other adults who are all enacting a social rite, which may not be entirely comfortable for everyone all the time, but is a lot more comfortable than denial. And you go there and you see this. You, first of all, I'm a great believer in the physicality of the dead, which is that you're there and they're right there in front of you. And this, we have this awful notion, I don't want to see them. I want to remember them as they really were. In that state, when they're dead, that is that transition state, they're no longer like any other human being that you've ever encountered before because they're no longer warm-blooded. Every human that you've ever met is a warm-blooded mammal. The first time that you touch a corpse, in that grasp of a corpse's hand, the shock of it is that they're cold, that they're moving between the person that you knew to this other state. But also, you have this strange counter view that they're just a shell, that this body is just a shell. And of course, that is equally maddening because the person, the body that you loved is there in that box. There's not some other entity, some free-floating spirit who really was them. It's that... it's the sort of mortal being incarnate in flesh, that we are incarnate in flesh, and when we die, our flesh is still there. But that is our identity. And our ancestors, you see, what our ancestors, they practiced every day for death. because they went to wakes and they had bigger funerals, and it was just there. There wasn't the same separation. So when you go there to that wake and see that and touch that dead body, what you're actually doing is you are participating in this absolutely ancient human right of physically acknowledging the deadness of those you love. In the Iliad, one of my favourite passages is the Trojan king, King Priam. The gods give him a message that they will allow him to go into the Greek camp and ransom his dead son Hector's body back off Achilles, the Greek champion. And this message comes in the form of sort of message from the gods. And when Priam says this to the women of the court, they say, you know, don't go, because Achilles, man slaying Achilles, will kill you too. And this old man says, this is obviously Homer writing in 850 BC, he says, I don't care if the Greeks kill me, just as long as I have the heart-comforting embrace of my dead son in my arms. So our ancestors revered the bodies of their dead, whereas we shun them. And it's such an incredible psychological contrast and physical contrast. The only special class of dead that we still revere in their dead bodies are the bodies of warriors. So we still make great efforts, British Army and the American Army, to take the bodies of soldiers back from the battlefield and bury them in sacred ground. But that's a very different contrast to our usual method of death in Western society, where you die, your relatives may not see your dead body. It may be 3 weeks, 4 weeks before you actually physically get buried or burned, and you're sort of housed somewhere. We don't know where. But, you know, our ancestors always kept their dead very, very close to them.
Mm.
Buried them in ancestral graveyards, physically accompanied them, which is what we did with my own father, is that he died in a small room in our family house where one of my brothers was born. He was in the sitting room for 48 hours. We took his coffin, we took him to the church, and then the next day we physically buried him ourselves on the mountain on the island. So he was laid to rest, as we would say, but always within our sight, as if we were protecting him and embracing him even in death. And that is a very ancient way of dying. And it has much to be said for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think outside of Ireland, it's the idea of actually physically touching your dead that scares a lot of people. I mean, for someone who hasn't grown up with this understanding of death, who hasn't practiced, say, I mean, do you have any advice for how you can sort of try and start to, I don't know, live that and have a maybe more healthy attitude?
I would say very simple is, you know, take courage. Go and see the person that you loved who's dead. Physically see what they are. I mean, part of the problem that arises in Western society at the moment is that there's a sort of rising sense of a failure of how to cope with grief. You know, how do we cope with grief in our society? Well, one of the worst ways to begin to grieve badly is to begin with an absence, so that the person that you loved, they don't really die; they disappear. They're in the hospital. And then they stop breathing.
And then they're wheeled away and you don't know where they've gone.
You never see them. 3 or 4 weeks later, usually in England and in America, it takes, you know, quite a considerable period of time to actually arrange the funeral. In Ireland, funerals take place within 3 days. And it's Ireland's pretty much the same kind of country. Most people live in cities. But people get buried very quickly. But in much in the more Western way of death, there's this sort of gap where the body really sort of disappears. You don't really know what's happened to it. Maybe it's in the hospital mortuary. Maybe it's with the undertakers. And then what you really have is a kind of rite of passage of a kind of common token where you have a closed box, very short ceremony in a crematorium that lasts half an hour. I wish you get fined. And then there's some sort of burial. And the gnawing psychological wound is, well, what really happened to them? You know, did they really die? Did they sort of disappear? It's a very common psychological grief reaction for your dead to appear within your dreams. It's almost like universal, certainly for the first 3 months, sometimes 6 months, sometimes obviously for the rest of your life. It's that odd disembodiment. So this creature appears in your dreams, but you physically have no knowledge of their transition.
Yeah, it's no wonder your brain struggles to cope with that reality, is it, really?
And part of the reason why our ancestors did do elaborate funeral rites like the wake is they believed, obviously, that the dead could kind of, the supernatural could intervene in the natural world. And one of the ways that you could intervene is you appear in the dreams of those who loved you. So what they were doing, obviously, by the wake and by a proper funeral ritual and by holding the body close, is making sure that the dead were properly laid to rest, the order was restored, that in a sense that the natural order of the world closed over this wound of mortality by people gathering around the family of the bereaved, by the right and proper funeral rites, rather than they just didn't take a body and dig a hole and chuck it in the ground. There were special places, special rituals. And all of these are ways of which you psychologically recognize death. It's a good foundation for this change. When you go to an Irish funeral, people come up to you and they shake your hands and they say, sorry for your trouble, sorry for your trouble, sorry for your trouble. Everyone does it. In fact, they do it so often that Irish undertakers advise their clients to take off their wedding rings or anything on your hand because your hands get bruised by the number of people who are actually shaking your hands. But at the same time, these people are saying this cliche, you know, sorry for your trouble, sorry for your loss. They're also like a bit of muscle memory. They're saying they're dead, they're dead, they're dead.
Yeah.
They're dead. And what they're doing is they're enforcing physically in your flesh this fusion of both physical and psychological reality that the person who you loved has died, that you're in this transitional state, that they're not coming back. And that's a very good way to begin the process of grieving.
Well, as opposed to being so terrified of saying the wrong thing that you don't say anything, which seems to be what happens here a lot.
I think also it's this counter to magical thinking, which Joan Didion writes about very powerfully in her book, The Year of Magical Thinking, where she found it very difficult to throw out her husband, John Dyden's shoes, because of course he would need them when he came back. And again, it's a very common grief reaction, is that you believe that the dead person will somehow magically reappear.
Mm.
That you're still psychologically adjusting to the kind of wound and hole in your life. So again, what a funereal ritual, a public funereal ritual, a communal funereal ritual like an Irish wake does, is it elevates your bereavement and the beginning of your grief onto a public stage where everyone is recognising that this event has happened and that you are dealing with a different reality in your life, a different psychological reality. Problem about much of sort of Western grief is that people feel unable to express their own sense of anguish, the sense of change. They don't see any public acknowledgement of their loss and their change, psychological reality. So in a way, what they do is they feel silenced in a death-denying culture. Yeah, it's literally as if they cannot speak or they cannot talk about this trauma that they feel. But that's because even if you think how we begin with such a narrow social and public acknowledgement, this body disappears. They're there and then you never see them again. Did they really die? Did they just somehow, were they rescued from the hospital mortuary? All of these strange, mad things that people do think about. But that's only natural. It's natural that in the trauma of grief that you, all manner of things come to the fore. Again, something like a wake gives you a forum where you can say things that are a bit crazy or off the top of your head, or you can grieve. You can unleash your emotions in a safe environment.
Yeah. And, so when you've been out and about and talking to people about these ideas and the value of having a more physical interaction with death, how do people respond? Is there much hostility or curiosity or fear?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not saying something that's new.
No.
I'm just saying something that's just very old, that is obviously widely practiced in Ireland, in Southern Europe, in most of the rest of the world. So it's really up to other people to evaluate that and come to their own judgment on it. I do know I've had very positive reactions to the book. I do know that people have, you know, sent me messages saying it's changed their own perspective, that in some cases they've literally have gone into the room to see their dead relative. It's shaped the way that they understand this public social ritual of dying. I mean, dying's not something that we are going to escape. So what we have to do, like this sort of training, is we have to find some way of training ourselves to cope with death in a social environment. Often I think in the Western dialogue about death, it's over-personalized. People write, and people do this, and I know this sounds a bit controversial, write books, sort of biographies of their own dying. But my death, or their death, is important. It's important to me personally, but it's not important to you. I mean, my death is not important to you, and a death is not important to you, because we're all going to die. But what is important is that we have a social mechanism by which I am able to relate to, help, understand the plight of other people who are experiencing death or the bereaved. We all have to have a social mechanism by which we are able to deal with this. And that's really, again, it goes back to simple. Well, how do you train people for a social mechanism which to sort of deal with the dead and the bereaved? Well, you do, again, you do something like an Irish wake, or you can reinvent it in different forms. But it's pretty simple just to stick with this very old model, which goes back it's at least 25,000 years old, if not older. The Aztecs keened and wailed and performed funereal rituals that are very similar to the ancient Greeks, even though the Aztecs were separated from old world culture by 25,000 years. So these are one of the oldest rites of humanity, because, of course, we are social creatures, and then we die in a social environment, a social society. So the society has always got to come up with some form of funereal rites in which to mark and acknowledge and obviously bury the dead.
Yeah, and, you know, today's way of doing it is to hide your grief as much as possible, it seems like. I think people feel very embarrassed about crying, even at funerals. I found it, so when I read the passages about keening, I found it incredibly hard to imagine, because I've never heard that and what it sounds like. And every experience of public mourning I've ever been to has been, you know, quiet sniffles, noses in handkerchiefs kind of thing. I mean, you're right that it is a simple thing to try and ask people to do, but it does seem like it's such a fundamental, hard right turn to somewhere to something new that we're not used to doing at all.
It's interesting that you're saying that, you know, it's something new. But in the Iliad, so the greatest warrior of all is Achilles. And then Achilles' lover Patroclus is killed in battle. And the Greeks rescue Patroclus' body. And then they take it to the Greek camp on the beach. And they put it on a kind of mound. And then what happens is Achilles, in his chariot with his men, ride round Patroclus' body. And they keen and wail. And Homer says that they keen and wail, and their tears wet the breastplates of their armour, and they wet the ground. And these are like the most incredibly sort of fierce, terrifying warriors, Myrmidons. And Achilles says, well, let's keep on doing this until we have had our fill of the pleasures of sorrow. So even these, this is sort of the equivalent of the kind of Navy SEAL
in tears. Yeah, the most masculine people you could imagine.
Yeah, and crying out. And there's nothing wrong with that. If it's good enough for Achilles, then it's good enough for me. And so we don't, our ancestors didn't see the shame that we have in psyche, the shame that we see in public sorrow. They think of it more as a strength. One of the, again, it's very common in wake cultures, is that you employed women as professional mourners. In Irish, this is the raw kinsha. But all the women used to keen and howl and give vent. Now, we worry because if you lose control, we somehow believe that you will never be able to regain it. But what our ancestors did was exactly the opposite, is they all howled and vented together. And in that public venting, there is a sort of psychic unity, that there's a great emotional strength, because what you are doing is what every other person in the room is doing, that you are combining in this one, it's like a sort of supra individual emotion, that you are, when people talk about this, it's similar. The only other time that you're allowed to unleash yourself in such a way is probably through orgasms, that you are allowed to give vent to, there's no sort of restriction. And instead of seeing this as dangerous, they saw this as good. They saw this as positive, that in this catharsis of emotion, that you relieve and foreshorten the grieving process. And you're also publicly acknowledging that. And a very similar process went on in my own father's wake, where his sisters, who are my aunts, came in, saw their dead brother, you know, cried out, keened. The wave of emotion carried through the room. Other women cried too. I cried as well. And we had this sort of moment where the emotional temperature of the room went up, and then it would settle down again and be a bit more pedestrian. Another mourner would come in and be the shaking of hands. And then if another close female relative came in again, there'd be another outburst. And we transmit emotions. We are social creatures. But gradually, over time, the emotional highs lessened. The catharsis of emotion drained away. These very powerful feelings of grief and loss. And we're doing it together. And if you were thinking of a sort of psychological program by which you could publicly acknowledge grief and all of these incredibly powerful emotions, some of the most powerful emotions you'll ever experience in your life, then that's a pretty good role model.
Yeah. So, I mean, has all this informed your thinking about your own death? Do you think about it more actively or not at all? Or...
Well, I think everyone thinks about their own death about 3 or 4 times a day. Depends on.
I don't know.
we're always, we have this little clock ticking away inside us. You know, am I going to die in this piece of parma ham? I'm going to fall off the tube lines and etc. That you cannot really walk around the world, climbing down steps there's always death possibilities lurk everywhere. How actively and animated that we think about them or worry about them is sort of another old concern. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, obviously, writing a book about death, you, I suppose you put yourself into a certain other class of human beings who obviously haven't written books about death. Whether that will be of help to me and my own death is always is an intellectual point. I don't. What I've learned from all of these experiences of being in places where people have died, or being in hospitals in Africa where people have been dying of plague around you, I think hopefully I won't be so afraid that you will have seen the process. That my own death is nothing special. I'm a human being. I'm mortal. I'm not going to live forever. By having encountered, seeing other people dying, for instance, my own father, he wasn't a philosopher. He wasn't, he was a very ordinary man. But he did have the advantage over most of us in that he knew how to die. May sound like a strange, abstract, weird skill. But he knew how to die simply because from the ages of 3 or 4, he'd been going to lots of wakes and he'd been seeing other people die. That the village where he grew up in, there would have been sick people amongst the living. You would see that. You would have some kind of knowledge of what it's like to sicken and die. And then you would see lots of dead bodies. You know, in the course of an ordinary life in Ireland, people would see dozens. Maybe by the time you're middle-aged, you would see hundreds of dead bodies. You've gone to hundreds of funerals. In a very ordinary way. I mean, we think, my God, how could they do that? So morbid. But they just go to a funeral and then they go on with the rest of their life. There's more sort of, it's more significant. People, if someone is close to them and the family is dying, they make a greater effort to go and see that person or to go to the funeral. It's a bigger social occasion. Again, this is just another way of dying. I mean, we die across the globe at the rate of 1% a year, unless it's catastrophe. So that means in a city like London, 85,000 people die each year. In Mayo, where my family are from, it's the same sort of death rate. I think the population is 160,000. So that's probably 1,600 people. What's different about it is that of that 1,600 people, their names are read out. When they die, their names are read out on the local radio station. So every day there's like the death, a little bit of solemn music, and then they read out the names of the 10 people who died that day. From the previous 24 hours. They talk about the funerals, they go on and stuff. It goes back almost to like John Donne, the great English poet, about the bell. He said, when you hear the bell, does it toll for thee? Or does it, you know, is it, no one is remote and entire. That bell tolls for all of us. It's that sort of acknowledgement. What the Irish still do is that they're acknowledging these deaths within their own community. They're going to the houses where these dead bodies are laying out, or they're going to the funeral homes, they're going to the masses, and then the burials. They're spending more of their social resources acknowledging those deaths. I've never heard that bell toll in London. I have actually really heard it, because I've heard it silently. You hear it like popping in Facebook, in the office where someone dies, and you feel, or like the maybe it's like the father or mother or relative, do you feel that you're able to sort of walk over the floor and shake their hands, or do you think, no, I can't possibly talk to him? So the bell is still striking away. It's that we almost positively don't listen to it. We sort of shut it down But it is still there if you want to hear it, because you know what? It's still at 1%. It doesn't change wherever you are across the globe.
Yeah. So what would you hope someone who read your book to take away as something they could actively do in our slightly death-phobic society?
Well, I've got a new book coming out, hopefully, called Nine Rules for Love, Grief and Death.
Do you want to spoil what they are?
One of them is, you know, about the pleasures of sorrow, that you just need to... you shouldn't be afraid to grieve. Don't be afraid of sort of losing sort of control. It's very odd that we think that just because you get very upset around death, that someone that you'll go mad, that someone like a kind of like a failure, that you will never be able to sort of return. Yeah, I mean, a lot of Hamlet is really interesting. It's about this, the problems of relentless grief, of unresolved grief. Hamlet's unresolved grief for his father and Ophelia's, and how that literally makes people, can make people mad. And that's almost like the model that we think is sort of, it's if you sort of burst out into tears and publicly acknowledge this, then you'll never be able to recover your sanity. But every previous generation to us, they believed, you know, that it was healthy to show emotion. So that's, I'd say, is very important. Like, showing emotion is really important. Being there, going to see your dead, that's the biggest and most important and simple lesson of all. Go and see them, because that which you loved and still love is changing, is both the dead are everything and nothing like us. And it's in that little gap that you learn more about your own mortality, of what it is to be mortal, than 5,000 books or 5,000 lectures. Those five first minutes when you are standing, touching, looking at, kissing the dead person that you loved will be the most important experiential 5 minutes of your life. What it is to be mortal, and what it is to undergo that change from the living into the dead.
I hope that this chat with Kevin gave you a lot to think about. However you end up feeling about death, it's always worth remembering that when it comes to celebrating and mourning your loved ones, you can do it in the way that works for you, and you certainly don't have to stick to convention. We're very grateful to Kevin for sharing his story and his perspective. His book is called My Father's Wake. There's a link in the description. This is the last episode in our current wave of podcasts, but we're always looking to talk to more people about death and dying, because we're all about starting more of those conversations. Keep an eye out for more, and don't hesitate to get in touch. You can keep up with us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Dying Matters.